in a mixture of rage and desire. "You didn't let him, did you?"
"Of course I didn't let him, Cyril. Give me some credit. Anyway, he didn't seem too bothered, because he didn't try again.
Although one good thing came out of it. He said that if I was going to go around kissing people, then I should clean my teeth first because my breath smelled of potato crisps. That was sound advice. I've stuck with it over the years, and it's got me far."
"But you were friends with Jasper until the end of school," I said,
recalling how I'd always felt a twinge of jealousy whenever I saw them together.
"Of course I was," said Julian, looking at me as if I was mad. "Why wouldn't I be? It was a right laugh, was Jasper. I looked him up when I was in Toronto last year, but he and his fella had gone off on a dirty weekend somewhere.
He'd love this, though," he added, tossing the copy of Tomorrow's Man on an armchair and returning to the bedroom, where he pulled open my wardrobe and looked inside judgmentally.
"But you should get rid of it, Cyril. People could get the wrong idea. Now, let's have a look at what you've got in here. This, maybe."
He held up a purple, wide-collared shirt that I'd bought in the Dandelion Market a few months earlier and had never got around to wearing.
"Do you think?" I asked. "Well, it's better than that granddad gear. Come on, put it on and let's get the night started. Those pints won't drink themselves."
I felt slightly self-conscious as I took my shirt off, and the fact that he continued to watch me as I dressed filled me with anxiety.
"How's that?" I asked. "Well, it's an improvement. If I'd had a couple of extra hours, I could have taken you into town and got you some proper gear. Doesn't matter."
He threw his arm around me, and I carefully inhaled the scent of his cologne, my lips unbearably close to his jawline.
"How are you feeling, anyway? Ready for the big day?"
"I suppose," I said,
not the most confident of replies, as we left the flat and made our way towards Baggot Street. I'd been living alone on Waterloo Road for a few years by now, employed as a researcher at RTE, where my workload was divided equally between religious programming and farming shows. I knew next to nothing about either, but found out quickly enough that all you had to do was hold a microphone in someone's face and he'd talk till the cows came home. We'd arranged to go to Donny and Nesbitt's, where some of my colleagues were gathered for the stag party, and I was a little anxious about introducing them to Julian. I'd spoken about him often, describing the many milestones of our friendship, but this would be the first time that these two important elements of my life had come into contact with each other. Over the years, I had created two fundamentally dishonest portraits of myself, one for my oldest friend, and another for my newest ones, and they had only a few brushstrokes in common. Revelations from either side could see the whole artifice fall apart, and with it the plans I had made for my future. "I was sorry to hear about you and Rebecca," I said, as we crossed the Grand Canal,
trying hard to conceal my delight that Julian had broken up with his latest squeeze.
"I thought you and her were well suited."
"Oh, that's old news," he said with a wave of his hand.
"Anyway, there's been an Emily since then, a Jessica, and now I'm on to a new Rebecca. Rebecca Mark II. Smaller tits, but fuck me, she's a spitfire in the sack. Not that it will last very long, of course. Another week or two, I'd say, at most."
"How do you get bored with people so quickly?" I asked, for the concept was one that I simply couldn't grasp. Had I been lucky enough to find a person with whom I wanted to have regular sex while still being able to walk hand in hand with him on the streets of Dublin without being arrested, I would never have let him go.
"It's not exactly boredom," he said, shaking his head. "But there's a whole world of women out there, and I'm not interested in being stuck with the same one for the rest of my life. There's been a few along the way, of course, that I wouldn't have minded a longer relationship with, but they insist on monogamy, and I'm not built for that."
"This might surprise you, Cyril, but I've never once cheated on a girlfriend."
"No, you just dumped them instead."
"Exactly.
And isn't that a more honest way to behave? But here's the thing, and I think everyone secretly believes this if they just let themselves admit it. The world would be a much healthier place if we allowed each other to do exactly what we wanted, when we wanted, with who we wanted, and didn't lay down puritanical rules for how to conduct our sex lives. We could live with the person we love the most for companionship and affection, but we could go out and have sex with willing partners and perhaps even talk about it when we get home. By that logic, I said, you and I could get married and live together forever.
Well, yes, he replied, laughing. I suppose we could.
Just imagine it.
Yes.
Anyway, these things are easy to say, I told him, trying not to linger on that idea too deeply. But you wouldn't like it if your girlfriend slept with someone else.
If you think that, he said, then you don't know me at all. I genuinely couldn't care less. Jealousy is an utterly futile emotion.
We passed Toner's on our left-hand side, and he marched across the road, the traffic coming to a halt to let him pass. When I followed in his wake a moment later, every car honked their horn at me. Pushing open the door to the pub, I could hear the buzz of the crowd within and looked around for my colleagues. I was expecting three of them, Martin Horan and Stephen Kilduff, two fellow researchers who shared an office with me, and Jimmy Burns, an on-air reporter who thought he was one of Ireland's biggest celebrities just because he'd appeared in a few episodes of 7 Days. When I found them seated together at a corner table, I raised a hand in greeting, but my smile faded when I saw that they'd been joined by a fourth person, Nick Carlton, a cameraman who worked on Wanderley Wagon, and whom I had gone to great pains to ensure heard nothing about this gathering. "Cyril!" they shouted, and I wondered how it would look if I bolted for the door and made a run for it down Baggot Street. Bizarre, I assumed. And so I introduced Julian to each of them in turn, and he took orders for a fresh round of drinks, striding over to the bar, where the crowd parted like Moses before the Red Sea to let him through. "Nick," I said, glancing at him as I sat down, "I didn't expect to see you here tonight." "Well, it's not my usual sort of establishment, I grant you," he said, lighting a Super King and holding it in his left hand, which he held at a right angle to his arm, his elbow resting on the table before him. "But I thought I'd come out and see how the other half lives." The truth was, I envied Nick Carlton. He was the only homosexual I knew who not only embraced his sexuality, but sang it proudly from the rooftops. But such was his good humour and his resolute lack of shame that no one seemed to mind. The other lads made jokes about him behind his back, of course, in order to emphasise their own rigid heterosexuality, but nevertheless they usually included him in their outings, and seemed to have adopted him as something of a mascot. "And I'm very glad I did now," he continued, glancing towards Julian, who was returning with a tray of pints. "Nobody said you were bringing Ryan O'Neill with you."
"Ryan O'Neill was on the Late Late Show a few weeks back," said Jimmy. "I'm surprised you didn't come down and stake out his dressing room, Nick."
"I was under strict instructions from the powers that be to leave him in peace," said Nick. "Spoil sports. Anyway, it was Miss O'Mahony's birthday that night, and she'd never have forgiven me if I hadn't shown up."
The lads guffawed, and I laid into my Guinness, downing about a third of it in one go.
"Have I seen you on 7 Days?
Julian asked Jimmy, who beamed with delight at being recognised.
"It's all showbiz here, I'd say, is it? You must get to see all the stars out at RTE."
"I've met Princess Grace of Monaco," said Stephen.
"I've met Tommy Doherty," said Martin.
"Occasionally, I write the script for Mr. Crow," said Nick.
Perhaps it was his clothes, or the way he talked, or the way he looked.
Perhaps it was the aura of sex that always emanated from him, as if he'd just risen from the bed of a model and left the house without even bothering to take a shower. Whatever it was, men, women, straight or gay, everyone wanted Julian to like them.
"Mr. Crow," said Julian, considering this for a moment. "He's the lad that pops out of the clock on Wanderley Wagon, is that right?"
"Yes,"
said Nick, flushing a little in glory.
"Get out of town!"
"That's my line," I said irritably, to no avail.
"Why do you watch it?"
asked Nick, ignoring me.
"I've seen it."
"It's a kids' show," I said.
"Yeah, but it's mad stuff. Are you on drugs when you're making it, or what?"
"I couldn't possibly comment," said Nick, winking at him. "But let's just say it's always a good idea to knock before entering anyone's dressing room."
"What is it you do yourself, Julian?" asked Stephen, offering him a cigarette, which he refused. Julian didn't smoke.
He had a phobia about it and always told girls that they would have to quit if they wanted a relationship with him.
I don't do very much at all, to be honest, he said. My old man's ridiculously rich, and he gives me a monthly allowance, so I just go off and do a bit of travelling. Once in a while, I write an article for Travel and Leisure or Holiday. Last year, I visited Mauritius with Princess Margaret, and Noel Coward wrote a piece about the wildlife there.
Did you fuck her?
Asked Nick casually. I did, yes, replied Julian, as if it was neither here nor there. Only once, but trust me, once was enough. I'm not keen on being ordered around.
Did you fuck him?
No, but he was polite enough to ask. She didn't. She just seemed to assume that's what I was there for.
Jesus Christ, said Jimmy, utterly enthralled.
That must be why you have such a good colour, said Nick. All that time spent on private islands populated by old money whores and nouveau riche shishi men. Any chance you'd take me with you next time? Julian burst out laughing and shrugged his shoulders.
Why not? He said. There's always room in my suitcase for a little one.
Who says I'm a little one? Asked Nick, faking offence.
Get me drunk enough and maybe I'll find out, said Julian.
And the whole table, with the exception of me, exploded in laughter. I don't want to point out the obvious, said Nick, when the merriment died down. But are you aware that you're missing an ear?
I am, said Julian.
And look.
He held up his right hand to display the four fingers that remained there.
I'm down a thumb too, and the little toe for my left foot.
I remember when you were kidnapped, said Martin.
For I had told them all before about the most famous incident of Julian's, and my own, life so far. We had bets in class on which body part would arrive in the post next.
And let me guess, said Julian, you all hoped it would be my dick?
Yeah, said Martin with a shrug. Sorry.
It's okay.
Everyone wanted that. Fortunately, it's still where it should be.
Prove it, said Nick, which made Stephen spit a mouthful of Guinness across the table, narrowly missing me.
Sorry, he said, grabbing a napkin to clean up the mess. Actually, they said they were going to pop an eye out next, said Julian. But I was found before that could happen. I asked Damien last year whether he thought they would have gone through with it, and he said they would.
Who's Damien? I asked,
having not heard him mention any friend by this name before.
One of the kidnappers, he replied. Do you remember the guy who threw me in the boot of the car?
Him.
We were all silent for a few moments, and I stared at him in bewilderment. Wait a minute, I said finally. Are you telling me that you've been in touch with one of those IRA guys?
Yeah,
he said with a shrug.
Did you not know that? We've been pen pals for quite a while now. I go on to visit him in jail occasionally, too.
But why? I asked, raising my voice. Why would you do that?
Well, it was a very intense experience, he said casually. I spent a week living with those guys under very trying circumstances, and you must remember that they weren't very much older than we were back then. They were almost as frightened as I was. Their overlords, or whatever you call them, had tasked them with kidnapping me, and they wanted to do it right, to get promoted up the ranks, so to speak. Actually, we got along quite well most of the time.
Even when they were cutting parts of you off? I asked.
Well, no. Not then. Although Damien never did that. In fact, he threw up when they cut my ear off. We get along very well now, as it happens. He's due for release in about 10 years. I dare say I'll take him out for a pint. Forgive and forget. That's my motto.
Well, good for you, said Nick. No pint holding a grudge, is there? I felt utterly uncomfortable sitting next to him because, although we didn't know each other well, he had seen a side of me that the others hadn't.
Shortly after I'd started working at RTE, a party had been organised for the spurious reason of celebrating Dana winning the Eurovision Song Contest, and a large group of us had ended up in a city centre pub in the small hours of the morning. I was already 3 sheets to the wind when I found myself out in a back alley taking a piss, and a moment later Nick appeared in the laneway too. I had never even fancied the man, but, depressed and horny, I took a chance and made a lunge for him before he could even start what he'd come out there to do, pressing him back against the wall and kissing him while grabbing his hand and pushing it down towards my cock.
He went with it for about half a minute before shaking his head and pushing me away.
"Sorry, Cyril," he said, looking at me with something approaching pity. "You seem like a nice fella, but you're just not my type."
I sobered up almost immediately. I had never ever been rejected and was dumbfounded that my advances should be rebuffed. In those days, homosexuals took what they could, where they could, and were glad of it. Attraction was considered a bonus, but never a requirement. When I woke late the next afternoon, the memory slowly returning to me like a ghastly nightmare that wouldn't go away, I was horrified by what I had done. I considered handing in my notice immediately at RTE, but it had taken too long for me to find a job that paid enough to allow me to live alone, and the idea of going back to sharing with someone was unbearable. And so I pretended that it had never happened, and in the 3 years since then had done my best to avoid him. But it was impossible to shake the knowledge that whenever he looked at me, he understood me better than anyone else alive.
"So let me get this straight," said Martin, looking towards me and Julian. "You two have known each other since your school days, is that right?"
"We shared a room for 6 years," said Julian.
"I bet Cyril loved that," said Nick, and I threw him a filthy glance.
"Although actually we first met when we were 7, I pointed out, wanting to stress just how long we had been in each other's lives. His father came to my house to meet with my adoptive father, and I found Julian lurking in the hallway.
"Cyril always tells me that," said Julian. "I don't remember it."
"Well, I do," I said quietly.
"I remember some lad when I was that age asking whether we could show each other our cocks, but Cyril claims that wasn't him."
The three lads spluttered over their pints, and Nick put a hand to his face. I could see his shoulders shuddering with laughter. I didn't bother to repudiate it again.
"And you're the best man?" asked Stephen when the teasing died down.
"I am," said Julian.
"How's the speech coming along?"
"It's almost there. I hope no one's too sensitive. It's a bit blue at times."
"Ah, Julian," I said, pulling a face. "I asked you to keep it clean."
"Don't worry. It's mild enough," he said, grinning at me. "Ass would kill me if I said anything out of order. So here's to Cyril anyway," he added, lifting his pint.
And the others did too. "A lifelong friend and 24 hours from now, my brother-in-law. My sister's a very lucky woman."
"She must have done something wonderful in a previous life," added Nick as he clinked his glass against mine.
Alice.
Although Alice's and my paths had crossed occasionally over the years, our romantic relationship had only begun some 18 months earlier at a party to mark Julian's departure to South America for a 6-month trek across the Andes. This was probably his most infamous escapade, as it involved travelling with his girlfriends at the time, a pair of Finnish twins by the name of Emmy and Peppy, who, he claimed, had been conjoined at birth and were only separated by an American surgeon when they were 4 years old. It was true that whenever I looked at them, they seemed to be leaning towards each other at a slightly unnatural angle. Only 2 years my junior, Alice had matured from a somewhat awkward adolescence into an incredibly beautiful young woman, a female version of Julian himself, sharing the fine cheekbones and deep blue eyes that had first drawn my adoptive father Charles to their mother Elizabeth, rather than the bulbous nose and amphibian-like eyes that they might have inherited from Max. She did not, however, share her brother's promiscuous ways, having spent 7 years dating a young medical student named Fergus, a relationship that had come to an end on the morning of their wedding when he telephoned just as she and Max were leaving Dartmouth Square for the church to tell her that he couldn't go through with it. "Cold feet," was his predictable and boring explanation, and within a few days he had disappeared off to Madagascar where, it was said, he was still working as a junior doctor in the leprosy clinic. I remember running into Julian by chance a few days later on Grafton Street, and can still recall the distressed expression on his face as he told me what had happened. He loved his sister deeply, and the notion of someone hurting her was unbearable for him.
"Don't feel you have to sit with me, Cyril,"
said Alice, as we looked over towards the corner of the bar, where Julian was seated like the meat in a Finnish sandwich while a group of his friends ogled them enviously, longing for a bite.
"If you'd rather go over there with the boys, I'm perfectly content with my book."
"They're all strangers to me," I said. "Where did he find them, anyway? They look like the cast of hair."
"I think they're what are commonly referred to as socialites," she said, her voice dripping with disdain. "The dictionary definition would be a bunch of self-regarding, narcissistic, physically attractive, but intellectually hollow individuals whose parents have so much money that they don't need to do a day's work themselves. Instead, they go from party to party, desperate to be seen, while gradually corroding from the inside out like a spent battery, due to their lack of ambition, insight, or wit."
"You're not a fan, then?" I asked,
and she just shrugged.
"Still, it sounds like more fun than getting up at 7 o'clock every morning and traipsing across the city to sit behind a desk for 8 hours."
"What are you reading, anyway?"
I asked, noticing the corner of a book poking out from her bag. And she reached down to retrieve a copy of John McGahern's The Dark.
"Isn't that banned?"
"I believe it is, yes," she said. "What's your point?"
"I don't have one, really."
"What's it about?"
"A boy and his abusive father. I should give it to Julian to read."
I said nothing. If there was any serious tension between her brother and father, I had never heard about it before.
"So tell me, Cyril," she said, "are you still working in the civil service?"
"Oh, no," I said. "I left there a long time ago. It wasn't for me. I work for RTE now."
"That must be exciting."
"It has its moments," I lied. "And what about you? Do you work?"
"I believe I do, but Max would say differently."
As I waited for her to continue, it struck me that she, like me, called her father by his Christian name.
"I've been researching and writing a PhD in English literature at UCD for the last few years. I wanted to go to Trinity, but the Archbishop wouldn't let me."
"Did you ask him?"
"I did," she said. "I went all the way to the palace in Drumcondra and knocked on the front door, bold as brass. His housekeeper wanted to kick me out into the gutter, of course, because I was wearing a dress that exposed my shoulders, but he invited me in, and I made my request in person. He seemed to think that I was a bit odd for wanting a career at all. He told me that if I put as much effort into finding a husband as I did into my studies, I'd have a home, a family, and 3 children by now."
"What a charmer," I said, laughing despite myself. "And what did you say?" "I told him that when your fiancé leaves you on the morning of your wedding, while 200 of your friends and family are waiting for you in a church hall half a mile away, then marriage isn't necessarily the first thing on your mind."
"Ah,"
I said, looking down at my shoes uneasily. "I suppose not." "He said I was a lovely girl, though," she added with a smile. "So I have that going in my favour at least. Anyway, as it turns out, I'm glad that I ended up in UCD. I've made some good friends there. I'll finish my degree in about a year's time, and the department has already offered me a teaching position for the following semester. I could be a professor in about 5 years if I keep my head down and don't lose my focus."
"And is that what you want?" I asked her. "To spend your life in academia?"
"It is," she said, looking around and wincing at the raucous noise coming from Julian's friends. "I sometimes feel as if I wasn't supposed to live among people at all, as if I would be happier on a little island somewhere, all alone with my books and some writing material for company. I could grow my own food and never have to speak to a soul.
I look at him sometimes," she added, nodding towards her brother, "and it's as if we were born with 2 life forces between us, but he got all of his share and half of mine, too." She didn't say this with any resentment or self-pity. It was clear to me from the look on her face that she adored him as much as I did, and I felt an instant kinship with her. Her idea of a safe haven appealed to me, too. A place I could go, simply to be left alone.
"Do you think that's because of..."
"Well, what happened?" I asked.
"Your desire to remove yourself from the world, I mean."
"Because of what Fergus did to me?"
"Yes."
She shook her head. "No, I don't think so," she said. I was a rather solitary child, and that didn't change much as I grew older. Although it didn't help, of course. That kind of humiliation has almost never visited upon a person. Did you know that Max insisted on the reception going ahead afterwards?
What?
I said, uncertain whether she was joking or not. It's true, she continued. He said that the wedding had cost him a fortune already, and he wasn't going to allow that amount of money to go to waste. So he dragged me off to the hotel in the Daimler that he'd booked for me in Fergus, and when we got out, the staff were all lined up along the red carpet. I could see some of them looking at us, wondering why has that young woman married a man old enough to be her father, and the rest thinking that was the reason I had such a miserable expression on my face. There was a champagne reception, where I had to go from person to person thanking them for coming and apologizing on Fergus's behalf, and then I was made to sit at the top table while the guests ate and drank to their heart's content. Max even made a speech, if you can believe it. He read it from a piece of paper and didn't change a word, because apparently he'd spent days on it. "This is the happiest day of my life," he said. "Alice deserves this. I've never seen a happier bride." It went on and on like that. It was almost comical.
"But why on earth did you go through with it?" I asked. "Why didn't you just go home? Or, you know, jump on a flight to Mars or someplace?"
"Well, I was a bit shell-shocked, I suppose. I didn't know what else to do. I loved Fergus, you see. Very much. And, of course, I'd never been jilted on my wedding day before," she added, smiling a little. Which meant I wasn't sure what the etiquette of the situation was. So I just did what I was told. "Fucking Max," I said, surprising both of us by my use of a word that I rarely employed. "Fucking Fergus," replied Alice.
"Fucking both of them.
What do you think? Should we have a couple more of these fucking drinks?"
"Fuck yes," she said,
and I grinned as I stood up to make my way to the bar. "You'll miss them, I suppose," said Alice when I returned with two large glasses of wine. 6 months is a long time."
"I will," I said.
"He's my best friend."
"Mine too,"
she said. "So what does that make us?"
"Rivals,"
I suggested, and she laughed. I was drawn to her. There was no question about that, not physically, but emotionally, temperamentally. For the first time in my life, I felt content to be seated in the company of a girl while Julian was somewhere else in the room. My eyes were not being constantly pulled in his direction, nor was I feeling jealous that others were dominating his time. It was an entirely new sensation for me, and one that I rather enjoyed. "Have you seen anyone famous out at RTE?" she asked me after a brief silence, during which I had racked my brain for something witty to say and come up short.
"Paul McCartney was there once," I said.
"Oh, I love Paul McCartney. I saw the Beatles when they played the Adelphi in 1963. I even went to the Gresham Hotel afterwards and pretended I was a guest so that I could get in to see them."
"Did it work?"
"No. Biggest disappointment of my life." She hesitated and then smiled at me. "Well, you know, that is until the obvious. Can I tell you something, Cyril?"
"Of course," I said.
"It's about my PhD, she said. "The thing is, I'm writing it on your mother's books."
"Really?"
I said, raising an eyebrow.
"Yes. Does that make you uncomfortable?"
"No," I said. "But you should probably know Maud was my adoptive mother, not my birth mother." "Yes, I know that," she said. "Where did they get you from, anyway? Were you found on the doorstep one day, or did you just wash in on the tide at Dunleary Pier?"
"The family legend has it that a little hunchbacked redemptress nun brought me to them," I told her. "They wanted a child, or they said that they did, and here was a child."
"And your birth parents? Have you ever tracked them down?"
"I've never even tried. I'm not that interested, to be honest."
"Why not?" she asked. "Are you angry at them?"
"No, not at all," I told her. "I had a reasonably happy childhood, which is rather strange in retrospect, as neither Charles nor Maud showed any particular interest in me at all. But they didn't beat me or starve me or anything like that.
I wasn't a Dickensian orphan, if you know what I mean. As for my birth mother, well, I dare say she did what she had to do. I assume she was unmarried. That's where adopted babies usually come from, isn't it? No, I don't feel any anger at all. What's the point?
That's good to hear. There's nothing more tedious than a grown man blaming his parents, birth or otherwise, for all the things that have gone wrong in his life.
You're assuming that things have gone wrong in my life.
There's something in your face that tells me that you're not happy. Oh, I'm sorry. That's a very personal remark. I shouldn't have said that.
No, it's fine, I said, although I felt a little crestfallen that she could read me so well.
Anyway, Fergus was like that, always blaming other people for issues that were his own to solve. It was one of the few things that I didn't like about him, if I'm honest.
So are you still angry at him? I asked, conscious that this too was a deeply personal question, but it balanced out what she had said to me. Oh, I hate him, she said, and I noticed a flush of colour come into her cheeks, and the manner in which the fingers of her left hand dug into her palm, as if she wanted something to take away her pain.
I absolutely detest him.
Afterwards, I didn't feel very much at all for a week or two. I suppose I was in shock. But then the fury rose, and it hasn't subsided since. Sometimes I find it difficult to control. I think it was around the time that everyone stopped asking me whether I was all right, when lives went back to how they had been before. Had he been in Dublin, I might well have gone over there, broken down his door, and stabbed him as he slept. Fortunately for him, he was in Madagascar with his lepers. I snorted some of my drink through my nose, and had to retrieve my handkerchief from my pocket to wipe my face. Sorry, I said, unable to stop laughing. It's just the way you put it. I'm not mocking you.
It's fine, she said, laughing now too, and I could see that it did her good to make light of it.
It is quite comical when you think of it. I mean, if he'd left me for Jane Fonda, then that would be one thing, but for a bunch of lepers? I didn't even know that there were lepers anymore. I only knew what they were because Max's favourite film is Ben-Hur, and I've been forced to watch it with him numerous times.
Well, it was his loss, I said.
Oh, don't patronise me, she snapped, turning serious again.
People always say that, you see, but they're wrong. It wasn't his loss. It was mine. I loved him.
She hesitated for a moment, and then repeated the phrase, with added emphasis on the crucial word.
And I still miss him, despite everything. I just wish he'd been honest with me, that's all. If he told me a few days before that he didn't love me enough to marry me, if we could have just sat down and discussed things, then even if he'd still wanted to call it all off, it would have been difficult, but at least I could have been part of the decision. I wouldn't have had to suffer such deep humiliation. But the manner in which he left me, simply telephoning when I was already in my dress to tell me about his ridiculous cold feet. What sort of man does that? And what sort of woman does it make me that if he walked in here right now, I'd probably throw myself into his arms?
I'm sorry that happened to you, Alice, I said. No one should have to endure such cruelty.
Fortunately for me, she said, looking down and wiping her eyes, where the tears were threatening to break over the banks of her eyelids, I had your mother to console me.
Your adoptive mother, that is.
I simply threw myself into my work. Her work. I've lived and breathed Maud Avery since then, and in her books I've found great solace. She was a wonderful writer.
She was, I said. I had at least read most of her novels by then.
It's as if she understood completely the condition of loneliness and how it undermines us all, forcing us to make choices that we know are wrong for us. With each successive novel, she explores the theme even more deeply. It's extraordinary. Did you read Malison's biography of her?
I glanced at it, I said. I didn't read it cover to cover. The woman he presented seemed very different to the woman I knew. as if she was a fictional character, not a real person. Or one of them was the Maud I knew, or the Maud who comes through from the pages of her books. Or both of them. Who knows?
You feature in it, you know.
Yes, I know. We were silent for a few moments until Alice spoke again.
I still find it astonishing that I live in the house that was once hers, she said.
And yours, I suppose. It was a nasty thing that Max did, buying it out from under Maud's feet when your father went to jail. And at such a knockdown price.
Well,
Charles had it coming, I said with a shrug. If he hadn't seduced your mother, then Max wouldn't have wanted revenge.
My mother likes to play the innocent victim in that story, she told me. But she was equally culpable.
No woman is ever truly seduced. It's a mutual decision on the part of the seducer and the seduced.
Ironically, the only person who really suffered was the one who had done nothing wrong.
Maud.
Exactly. Maud. She lost her home. She lost her writing room. She lost her sanctuary.
To have a place where you feel safe, where you can work, is more important than anyone can realize until it's gone, especially for a woman. And, of course, she died not long afterwards.
Yes, but that was a smoking, I said, beginning to feel a little upset by the turn the conversation was taking. The grief and pity that Alice felt for my adoptive mother had never been equalled by me in the 20 years since her death, and it shamed me that this was the case. It wasn't as if she died of a broken heart or anything.
But it couldn't have helped.
Don't you think the two things were connected? That the cancer took over completely because of all the things she'd lost?
No, I think she died because she spent all her adult life puffing on cigarettes non-stop from the moment she woke up in the morning until the moment she went to sleep at night.
Well, perhaps you're right, said Alice in a conciliatory tone. Of course, you knew her and I didn't. Perhaps you're right, she repeated.
Another long silence followed. And I thought we were finished talking about Maud, but no. She had one more thing to tell me.
I met her once, you know, she said, when I was just a child. I was about 5 or 6 years old, and Max had taken me and Julian over to Dartmouth Square for a meeting with your father. I think it was around the time of the court case. Anyway, I needed the bathroom and went upstairs in search of it, but, of course, the house is so large and there are so many floors that I got lost and wandered into what I suppose was her office. At first I thought the house was on fire because the room was simply filled with smoke.
Yes, that was her office, I said.
I could barely see through it to the other side. But gradually my eyes grew accustomed to it, and I saw a woman seated at a desk wearing a yellow dress staring at me and trembling slightly. She didn't move, but just raised her hand like the ghost of Christmas yet to come, pointed in my direction, and then she uttered a single word, a question. Lucy? And I froze, terrified and uncertain what to do. She stood up and walked slowly towards me, and although she was pale as a ghost, she stared at me as if I was the ghost, and when she reached out to touch me, I became so utterly terrified that I ran from the room and went screaming down the stairs before charging out the front door. I didn't stop running until I got to the other side of Dartmouth Square, where I hid behind a tree waiting for my father and brother to reappear. I'm pretty sure I wet my pants in fright.
I stared at her, astonished and delighted by the story.
I'd always remembered the strange little girl in the pale pink coat running through the house as if the Hound of the Baskervilles was after her, but had never known what had happened to frighten her so badly. Now at last I knew. There was something comforting in laying that story to rest.
Lucy was her daughter, I said. She must have thought that you were her.
Her daughter? There's no mention of a daughter anywhere in Mellicent's biography.
She was stillborn, I explained. Maud had a terrible pregnancy, I believe, which is why she couldn't have children afterwards.
Right, said Alice, and I could see that this information was something that might be useful to her in her thesis. Anyway, that was my only encounter with her, she continued, until I decided to make a study of her work, that is, 2 decades later.
She'd be dismayed if she knew that you had, I said. She hated any form of publicity.
Well, if it wasn't me, it would be someone else, she replied with a shrug.
And there will be others. She's simply too important not to write about, don't you think?
What was she like, anyway? Sorry, I'm not fishing for my thesis. I'm genuinely interested.
It's hard to say, I replied, wanting to move on to other subjects. I lived with her for the first 8 years of my life, but our relationship was never what you'd call close. She wanted a child, which was why she and Charles adopted me. But I think she wanted one in the same way that she wanted a Persian rug or a light fitting from the Palace of Versailles. Just to have, you know? She wasn't a bad woman. Not really. But I can't say I ever got to know her. After Charles went to prison, it was just the two of us for a few months. But she was already dying by then, so we never had a chance to talk as parents and children should.
Do you miss her?
Asked Alice.
Sometimes, I said.
I almost never think of her, if I'm honest, except when people mention her books. They've become so highly thought of that I occasionally get letters from students asking for help with their thesis.
And do you offer it?
No. It's all there in the books themselves. There's nothing much I can add that would be of any use to anyone.
You're right, said Alice. So why any of them feel the need to talk about their work in public or give interviews is beyond me. If you didn't say what you wanted to say in the pages themselves, then surely you should have done another draft.
I smiled. The truth was that I wasn't a big reader, and knew next to nothing about contemporary literature, but I liked the fact that Alice did. Maud, without the coldness.
Do you write yourself? I asked,
and she shook her head.
No, I wouldn't be able, she said. I don't have the imagination. I'm a reader, pure and simple. I wonder how long I have to stay here, anyway. There's nothing I'd like more than to go home and curl up with John McGahern. Metaphorically speaking, of course.
She blushed almost immediately and reached out to touch my arm.
I'm so sorry, Cyril, she said. That was rude of me. I don't mean I'm not enjoying your company.
I am.
It's all right, I said, laughing.
I know what you meant.
You're very different to Julian's other friends, she remarked. They're all so boring and vulgar, and whenever I'm around them, they say things to try to shock me. They think because I'm bookish and mousy that I will squeal at their vulgarities, but they're wrong. I'm actually quite unshockable.
I'm glad to hear it, I said.
Have you spoken to the Finnish twins?
No, I said. What's the point? They'll be gone by the next time I see Julian.
True. Life's too short to make the effort. And what about you, Cyril? Do you have a set of Finnish twins of your own hidden away somewhere? Swedes? Norwegians?
Or just one girl, if you want to be old-fashioned about things?
No,
I said, feeling a little uncomfortable that the conversation was turning towards my romantic life, or lack thereof. No, I've never had very much luck in that department, I'm afraid.
Oh, I don't believe that for a moment.
You're nice-looking, and you have a good job. You could probably get any girl you want. I glanced around. The music was so loud that no one could overhear us, and something inside me felt suddenly tired of subterfuge.
Can I tell you something? I said. Is it something scandalous? She asked, smiling at me.
I suppose so, I said.
It's something I've never told Julian, but somehow, I don't know why, I just feel I can trust you with it. The expression on her face changed a little, from amused to intrigued. All right, she said. What is it?
Promise you won't tell your brother.
Promise you won't tell her brother what? Asked Julian, appearing behind our seat suddenly.
And I jumped as he leaned between us, planting a quick kiss on his sister's cheek and then a quick kiss on mine.
Nothing, I said. The moment lost, pulling away from him and feeling my heart rate elevating dramatically within my chest.
Oh, go on, tell me.
Just that I'm going to miss you when you're gone, that's all.
Well, I should think so too. Best friends are hard to come by, after all. Now, who's for another drink?
Alice raised her empty glass at him and he scampered off back to the bar as I looked down at my shoes.
So, she asked, what was it?
What was what?
You were about to tell me something.
I shook my head. Another time, maybe. It was what I said, I told her. That I'll miss him. That's all. Well, what's so scandalous about that? I was hoping for something far more juicy. Sorry, I said with a shrug. I suppose it's not the sort of thing men generally say about their friends, is it? We're supposed to be stoical and keep our feelings to ourselves. Who says so? Everyone, I told her. A few days later, after Julian had departed for South America, I was at home one evening when the telephone rang. Cyril Avery, I said when I lifted the receiver.
Oh, good, said a voice, a female voice. I was hoping I had the right number.
I frowned. Who's this? I asked.
It's the voice of your conscience. You and I need to have a little talk. You've been a very bad boy, haven't you?
I said nothing but pulled the receiver away from my ear for a moment and stared at it in bewilderment before slowly bringing it back.
Who is this? I repeated. It's me, silly. Alice. Alice Woodbead.
I hesitated for a moment, uncertain why on earth she was calling me. What's the matter? I asked, panicking slightly.
It's not Julian, is it? He's all right, isn't he? Yes, he's fine. Why shouldn't he be?
No reason. I'm just surprised to hear from you, that's all.
You mean you weren't waiting by the phone for me to call?
No. Why, should I have been?
You really know how to flatter a girl, don't you?
My mouth opened and shut a few times. Sorry, I said. That came out wrong. I'm starting to feel a little foolish now.
No, no,
I said quickly, aware that I was behaving quite rudely.
I'm sorry.
You caught me unawares.
Why? What were you doing?
Not much, just sitting around flicking through some pornography and wondering whether I had time for a quick wank before dinner would have been the truthful answer. I was reading Crime and Punishment, I said.
Never read it.
Always meant to. Any good? That's okay. There isn't a lot of crime, but rather a lot of punishment. Story of my life. Look, Cyril, say no if you want to.
No,
I said.
What?
You told me to say no if I wanted to.
Yes, but let me ask the question first. Good God, you don't make this easy on a girl, do you?
Sorry. What did you want to ask?
I wondered.
She trailed off and coughed for a moment. And for the first time she began to sound less confident. Well, I wondered whether you might like to join me for dinner some evening?
Dinner?
I asked. Yes, dinner. You do eat, don't you?
I do, I said. I have to, otherwise I get hungry.
She paused.
Are you teasing me?
No, I said. I'm just not used to this, that's all. So I am probably saying stupid things.
I don't mind. I say stupid things all the time.
So we've established that you eat to fend off the hunger pangs. Would you care to eat with me this weekend, perhaps?
Just the two of us.
And the other people in the restaurant. I won't be cooking for you. I am not that domesticated. But we don't have to talk to any of the other people there unless we run out of things to say.
I thought about it. I suppose we could do that, I said.
I think I need to sit down, she replied. Your enthusiasm is overwhelming me.
Sorry, I said again, laughing now. Yes, dinner. You and me, and a restaurant, this weekend.
That sounds good.
Excellent. I'm going to pretend that wasn't like pulling teeth and look forward to it. I'll drop you a line before Saturday with a time and place, all right?
All right.
Goodbye, Cyril.
Goodbye, Alice.
I hung up and looked around, uncertain how I was supposed to feel. Was this a date? Was she asking me out on a date?
Were women even allowed to ask men out on dates? I shook my head and went back to my room. I didn't feel like a wank anymore, and I didn't feel like dinner either. A few days later, however, I found myself sitting opposite Julian's sister in a restaurant talking about something inconsequential, and she reached across,
placed her hand atop mine and looked me directly in the eye.
"Can I just get something out in the open, Cyril?" she said,
the scent of her lavender perfume a pleasant note in the air.
"Of course," I said,
nervous about what she might be about to say.
"The thing is, I felt a strong connection with you at Julian's going-away party, and hoped that you might call. Actually, I always liked you whenever we met in the past, but of course I was with Fergus then. But of course you didn't call, so I called you instead. I'm shameless, I know. Anyway, I don't know whether you're seeing anyone or not. I assume not, or you probably wouldn't have agreed to come out tonight. But if you are, or if you're not interested in me in the slightest, could you just let me know? Because I don't want any misunderstandings between us, not after everything I've been through. I quite like you, you see."
I looked down at the plate before me, breathing deeply in and out. I knew immediately that this would be one of the defining moments of my life.
I could tell her the truth, as I had intended the previous week, confide my secrets in her and ask for her friendship. If I did so, there was a good chance that she would be a better friend to me than her brother had ever been. But at that moment, lacking the courage, to be honest, I simply didn't feel ready. A few dates wouldn't hurt anyone. I enjoyed her company. It wasn't as if we were getting married or anything.
"No, I'm not seeing anyone," I told her, looking up and smiling, despite myself. "And of course I'm interested in you. What normal man wouldn't be?"
8 words.
I imagine that everyone around that table assumed that I was a virgin, when the fact was I had probably had more sex than any of them, even Julian, albeit in far less romantic settings. But they had experienced things that I never had, pleasures that I felt certain were superior to the ephemeral thrill of a quickly forgotten climax. I knew nothing, for example, of foreplay or seduction, of how it might feel to meet a stranger in a bar and strike up a conversation, mindful of the possibility that it might lead somewhere more interesting. The truth was, if I was not screwing within 10 minutes of meeting a man, then it was probably never going to happen at all. My Pavlovian response to an orgasm was to pull up my pants and run away. I had never had sex during daytime. Instead, it was a shameful activity to be conducted in haste, in hiding, and in darkness. I associated sexual congress with the night air, with the outdoors, with my shirt on and my trousers around my ankles. I knew the sensation of tree bark imprinting itself against the palms of my hands as I fucked someone in a park, and the smell of sap against my face as a stranger pushed against me from behind. Sex was not scored by size of pleasure, but by the scurrying urgency of rodents in the undergrowth, and the sound of cars rushing past in the distance, not to mention the associated fear that from those same roads might come the unforgiving scream of Garda sirens, responding to the outraged phone call of a traumatized dog walker. I had no idea what it would be like to wrap my arms around a lover beneath the sheets as we fell asleep, whispering words of gentle affection that drifted carelessly into sleepy tenderness. I had never woken with another person, or been able to satisfy my tenacious early morning desire with an unapologetic partner. I could number more sexual partners in my history than anyone I knew, but the difference between love and sex could be summed up for me in 8 words. I loved Julian. I had sex with strangers. And so I wonder what would have surprised them more. To have known all that, or to have learned that I had, in fact, had sex with a woman. Only once, granted. But the extraordinary moment had taken place 3 weeks earlier when, to my surprise, Alice insisted that we go to bed together, and, even more surprisingly, I had agreed. Intimacy was one of the things that I had managed to avoid over the 18 months of our courtship, and for once I found myself grateful to be living in Ireland, a country where a homosexual, like a student priest, could easily hide their preferences by disguising them beneath the murky robes of a committed Catholic. Naturally, as it was only 1973 and we were children of our time, it was a subject that Alice and I were shy of discussing aloud, and so we used the person we had in common, Julian, as our conduit into the subject.
He has sex with different people constantly,
I whined a few weeks before the wedding as we sat in Doyle's on College Green. Both of us a little excited from having watched Robert Redford and Paul Newman alternate between T-shirts, tuxedos, and slicked back hair for 2 hours in the Sting. I was in one of those moods when my resentment at her brother's sexual prowess and unyielding heterosexuality put me in the mood to belittle him.
He basically does with anyone he wants, which is really disgusting when you think about it. But is he actually happy?
Are you kidding me, Cyril? Alice replied, amused by the absurdity of my question.
I'd say he's ecstatic. Wouldn't you be?
I knew she was teasing me, but I didn't laugh. Sex hovered around the edges of our lives like an anxious guest at a party. It was obvious that sooner or later one of us would have to bite the bullet and go over to say hello. I just didn't particularly want it to be me.
Did I mention, she said,
not quite looking me in the eye,
that Max and Samantha are going to London next weekend?
No, I said. Samantha was Max's second wife. Much like my own adoptive father, who that year was engaged to the woman who would become, albeit briefly, the fourth Mrs. Avery, Alice's father had obtained a divorce from Elizabeth in the UK on the grounds of unreasonable behaviour. In fairness to him, he had cited his own unreasonable behaviour in the suit, not hers, for after all, the most unreasonable thing that she'd ever done, aside from her brief affair with Charles, was stay with the bastard. Shortly after the decree nice I had come through, Max had married an aspiring actress who bore an uncanny and deeply disturbing resemblance to Alice herself. This was a subject that was absolutely off-limits, although I was often keen to ask Julian whether he noticed the likeness and, if so, what he made of it.
"We should go to London sometime," she continued.
"I dare say we'll have plenty of holidays to look forward to after we're married," I said. "We could go to Spain some day. That's very popular, or Portugal."
"Portugal?" she said, raising an eyebrow in mock excitement. "Do you really think so? I never imagined I could be the kind of girl who would grow up and get to go to Portugal."
"All right, then, America," I said, laughing. "Or Australia. Anything's possible. We'd have to save for an awfully long time if we wanted to go that far, but..."
"It's hard to believe that I'm 26 years old and I've never set foot outside Ireland."
"Well, I'm 28, I pointed out, "and neither have I. What are they doing in London anyway?"
"Oh, Samantha has a meeting with Ken Russell."
"Who's Ken Russell?" "Film director, you know, The Devils, Women in Love, Oliver Reed and Alan Bates wrestling with their bits hanging out."
"Oh, yes," I said. "It's all soft porn, isn't it?"
"Well, I suppose it depends on how old you are," she said. "For our parents' generation, yes, it probably is. For us, they're art films."
"I wonder what our children will call them," I said.
"Quaint, but terribly passé, I suppose."
"Children?" she said,
looking across at me hopefully.
"It's funny we've never talked about children, isn't it?
Considering we're getting married in a few weeks' time."
"Yes, I suppose so," I said. And for the first time in my life it occurred to me that I had never given any thought whatsoever to the idea of being a father. I paused to think about it and found that the idea quite appealed to me. Perhaps I had never allowed myself to consider it before because I knew how impossible it would be. "Would you like to have a family, Cyril?" she asked me.
"Well, yes," I said.
"Yes, I think I probably would.
I'd quite like to have a daughter, or many daughters."
"Like a gentleman from a Jane Austen novel. You could settle £1,000 and 100 acres in Hertfordshire in each one after your death."
"And if they quarrelled, their punishment would be an afternoon in the company of the local Miss Bates."
"I think I'd prefer a son," said Alice, looking away. And I noticed her eyes drift to an incredibly handsome young man who had just walked into the pub.
Her eyes lingered over his body as he leaned over the bar, glancing at the beer pumps as he made his choice.
She swallowed suddenly, and for the first time I saw real lust in her eyes. I didn't blame her. I would have climbed over the dead bodies of my closest friends to get to him myself. But when she looked back, the smile she wore was one of resignation, as if she wanted that, but had to settle for this. And this wasn't even much good to her so far in the department that really mattered. I felt a stab of guilt, and found myself locked into pained silence. Suddenly, the Austin jokes seemed absurd and embarrassing.
"What were we talking about?"
she asked, eventually, her train of thought having not only derailed but jumped the tracks entirely, driven over a cliff and crashed 100 feet into a ravine below.